Welcome to the debate. Imagine you are driving down the highway at, 70 miles an hour, and suddenly the check engine light flashes on your dashboard.
Oh, I hate that feeling.
Right. It's the worst. You can actually hear the engine grinding. The car is physically losing speed. Now, imagine pulling over to the shoulder, taking out a piece of thick black tape, and carefully covering up that warning light.
Just ignoring it entirely.
Exactly. You sit back, you look at the now dark dashboard, and you say, there, the problem is fixed.
I mean, it sounds totally absurd when you frame it like that, but it is exactly what we do. The warning signal is gone, so you assume the underlying condition is resolved. It is psychologically comforting. Look, human beings love when our metrics look clean, even if the reality underneath those metrics is completely falling apart.
Precisely. And that illusion, treating this symbol of a thing as if it were the actual living thing itself, is the beating heart of the text we are exploring today. We are looking at Dr. Bechara Saheli's June 2026 academic white paper. It's called The Tears of Life, a life-coherent framework for recognizing harm, restoring conditions, and reorienting power.
It is quite the title.
It is. But the paper brilliantly diagnoses how our modern human systems fall into this trap that Saheli calls symbolic substitution. We preserve the symbols of progress, or love, or intelligence, while we actively disable the actual material conditions that life needs to survive.
Right.
And the core disagreement we are debating today really centers on the author's proposed solution. I am representing the side that argues Saheli's life-coherent framework, which introduces concepts like prophetic grief and allowing the tears of life to inform governance, actually provides a rigorous, deeply actionable, and necessary seven-step grammar. It is a diagnostic tool to force systems to move away from performative care and return to actual life capacity.
And I take the contrasting view here. I will absolutely concede that the paper's diagnosis of symbolic substitution is, frankly, one of the most brilliant, incisive articulations of systemic failure I have ever read.
It really hits hard.
It does. But its proposed cure is fundamentally flawed. Relying on contemplative concepts like attunement and tears, well, it lacks the hard structural mechanisms required to actually counter the problem. I mean, the text itself warns us about the entrenched inner algorithms of institutional capture, and I plan to show why you just cannot fight a structural algorithm with a qualitative emotion.
Okay, let's start by really unpacking that diagnosis, because we agree that the concept of symbolic substitution is incredibly powerful. To understand the framework, we first have to explain the difference between a symbol and a condition.
Yeah, that distinction is crucial.
Right. A symbol points toward meaning, but a condition is what actually enables life. Saheli argues that our modern crises are fundamentally failures of recognition. We literally mistake the signs of life for the conditions of life.
Right, and the paper uses some fantastic examples to illustrate this.
It really does. Look at modern medicine. A hospital might preserve the symbol of treatment, which, you know, means they track the number of prescriptions written, the procedures billed, patient throughput metrics, things like that.
The dashboard metrics.
Exactly, the clean dashboard. But while optimizing those symbols, they completely neglect the conditions of healing. Because healing requires the patient to have stable relationships, a safe environment, and it requires the caregiver to have the actual time and well-being to provide care.
Right, you can't bill for actual well-being.
No, you can't. Or look at economics. We relentlessly preserve the symbol of value, which we call GDP or stock price, while actively degrading the ecological life ground that actually keeps us breathing.
Look, the diagnostic strength there is undeniable. It cuts right through institutional hypocrisy. It gives us language for why a company can boast about its record profits while its workforce is entirely burnt out and the local river is polluted.
Exactly. And to combat this, Saheli doesn't just offer a sentimental philosophy. The paper introduces a concrete metric grounded in living systems theory. And that is, does this system help life continue, recover, and flourish?
Continue, recover, and flourish.
Yes, that triad is the test. The text lays out a seven-step framework that moves from seeing the wound and allowing the tears, all the way down to making the repair real. It gives us an empirical way to evaluate whether an institution is enabling the capacities proper to life, like breathing, healing, and participating, or if it is merely engaging in what Saley calls performative care.
And performative care perfectly encapsulates the bureaucratic theater we live in. I mean, it is the corporate apology without the financial restitution. It is the PR campaign about sustainability while the oil extraction just continues.
Yes, it forces a return to material reality.
I hear that, but let me push back on the mechanics of this proposed cure, because this is where the paper loses me. It vastly underestimates its own diagnosis. Saley draws heavily on peace research to point out that cultural harm normalizes injury.
Okay.
Cultural harm teaches people not to even see harm as harm. Yet the framework turns around and asks these very same captured institutions to allow the tears and achieve attunement. This is structurally mismatched. The paper explicitly notes that these systems are built on inner algorithms of capture.
Right. The internal logic of the system.
Exactly. Think of an inner algorithm like the core operating system of a bureaucracy. If the algorithm is fear-seeking security, you get a surveillance state. If it is status-seeking elevation, you get hyper-competitive corporate extraction. You are asking an extracted marketplace to somehow experience prophetic grief. It is applying a contemplative solution to a ruthless algorithmic problem.
Wait, I need to stop you there and play the role of the skeptic for a second, because I think we need to define our terms. If I am a listener right now hearing the phrase prophetic grief or allowing the tears, I am probably picturing a corporate board of directors sitting around a mahogany table weeping into their hands over quarterly earnings.
I mean, it would be quite a sight.
It sounds absurd, but that is not what the text is arguing at all, is it?
Well, it uses highly evocative, qualitative language. It asks for a conversion of outrage into attunement.
I mean, I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective. The text explicitly defines tears not as a public emotional display, but as the interior recognition that something living has been wounded. It is about feedback. Let me offer an analogy to ground this.
Sure.
Think of a biological nervous system. A living body requires the sensation of pain. Pain is what triggers the immune response, right? It is what tells you to pull your hand away from a hot stove to avoid further injury.
Basic biology.
Exactly. Leprosy, as a disease, is so devastating not just because it attacks tissue, but because it destroys your nerve endings. You physically cannot feel the pain, so you leave your hand on the stove until it burns to the bone. Right now, our institutions have organizational leprosy.
Wow, that is a striking image.
They have intentionally severed their feedback loops. The people at the top do not feel the pain of the people at the bottom or the pain of the ecosystem. The tears of life is Sahali's conceptual requirement to unblock those severed nerve endings so the system stops being dangerously self-referential.
Okay, but
it's not about crying. It is about reestablishing the feedback loop of pain so the system can actually survive. Without that sensation, you can't even begin the final step of making the repair real.
Look, I understand the leprosy analogy, but I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that. Let me tell you why. You are assuming the institution is the body and that it fundamentally wants to heal itself. What if the institution is a parasite feeding on the host?
A parasite?
Let's look at the text's own sequence of healing. You move from the wound to outrage, to tears, to truthful naming, to compassion, and finally to repair. The fatal flaw here is that institutions actively intentionally bypass the sequence. When a corporation causes harm, they move directly from the wound to the public relations department.
Well,
they move from injury to litigation. They do this specifically to avoid feeling the pain of the wound, because acknowledging the pain creates liability.
But that is exactly what the framework is designed to interrupt.
How? If an institution's survival depends on conserving profit, which Saley completely acknowledges in step 5 of the framework, calling it tracing the conserving pattern, then that institution will instinctively block attunement. It has to. How can a theoretical framework successfully mandate tears in an entity fundamentally designed to externalize its damage?
But it's not an entity in a vacuum.
The text is essentially asking the system to stop defending its innocence. But defending its innocence is the exact mechanism by which the system survives.
I read that entirely differently. You are treating the institution as a monolith, as if it exists completely independent of the human beings inside it. Sanzelli points out that these inner algorithms of capture, fear, shame, the desire for control, they begin within human beings.
True, but they scale up.
Yes, they scale up and become institutionalized, but they are ultimately sustained by people. The framework is meant to be a discipline of attention for the policymakers, the physicians, the software engineers, and the citizens who actually comprise the system.
Individual discipline against a structural algorithm.
When an engineer designing an algorithm allows the suffering of the end user to interrupt their automatic defense of the code, that is allowing the tears. It provides a rigorous grammar for people inside and outside the system to demand those feedback channels be reopened. If the harmed cannot speak, the system cannot correct itself.
Relying on individual software engineers or middle managers to have a moment of contemplative awakening is exactly why I call it a structural mismatch. The inner algorithms we are talking about are scaled beyond individual choice. A market organized around desire amplification inevitably becomes an attention economy.
Sure.
A bureaucracy organized around control inevitably becomes a surveillance state. These aren't just collections of people acting badly, you know. They are architectures. And the ultimate stress test for this, which the paper tackles head-on, is artificial intelligence. You want to talk about scaled algorithms? AI is the automation of the parasite.
Okay, let's absolutely talk about AI, because I believe this is exactly where the framework transitions from theory into incredibly practical utility. The text does not treat AI as a mere technical hurdle. It frames it as a defining test case of our era. Solly categorizes AI into five potential roles, and they are brilliant. AI as a tool, an oracle, an idol, an enclosure, or a commons.
It is a phenomenal taxonomy, I'll give you that.
It really is. And the Life Coherent framework provides a clear, actionable boundary for governance based on those roles. It says AI must be governed as a tool, meaning it is bounded, transparent, and specifically designed to augment human judgment rather than replace it.
Right.
Or it must be governed as a commons, meaning it is shared infrastructure regulated for education, care, and ecological responsibility. Simultaneously, the framework accurately identifies the severe dangers. AI becomes an enclosure when it captures our attention, our language, and our labor.
Which is exactly what's happening.
And it becomes an idol when it demands excessive trust and obedience from us. By forcing us to evaluate AI through the lens of whether it supports the conditions for life to continue, recover, and flourish, the framework gives policymakers an actual compass.
It is a great compass. But a compass doesn't stop a bulldozer. Consider the contradiction embedded in the seventh step of the framework when we apply it to AI. The seventh step is make the repair real through what the text calls minimal sufficient intervention.
Yes.
Now, I agree with the five roles, but focus on the text's own explicit warning. AI externalizes and radically accelerates the inner algorithms of its creators. If an extractive market governs the AI, the AI will scale extraction at the speed of light. Let's look at AI as an enclosure. Enclosure historically meant fencing off public land so private companies could profit from it. But an AI enclosure fences off the very medium of human meaning-making.
What does that look like in practice? For the listener who might find meaning-making a bit abstract?
Think about relying on a generative AI to write your wedding vows. Or a therapist using an AI to generate their session notes and empathy responses. The AI perfectly simulates a deep human emotional connection. It encloses our language, our classification systems, our memory. How in the world is a minimal sufficient intervention going to do anything against a technology that operates at a planetary scale to simulate intelligence while actively de-skilling human relationships?
Ah. But that argument assumes minimal means weak or small. And that is a misinterpretation of how Saheeli uses the term minimal sufficient intervention in this context. It does not mean a light tap on the wrist.
Well, it sounds like it.
The text defines it as an intervention that deliberately avoids domination, one that restores the living system's own capacity for regulation and relationship. It is the opposite of forcing a top-down authoritarian fix. Let's take your AI enclosure example.
Okay.
If AI is enclosing human meaning-making, the minimal sufficient intervention might literally mean completely dismantling the surveillance and data extraction architecture behind it, so that public, human reasoning can recover. It is about removing the disabling constraint.
Dismantling the data architecture of the largest companies on Earth is called minimal?
Yes, because the goal is not to replace their control with a new form of state control. The goal is to remove the blockage so the human condition can breathe again. If AI is substituting fluent language for actual truth, the intervention is to legally and structurally reestablish human responsibility. The framework allows us to clearly identify that symbolic intelligence is substituting for actual wisdom. That is a massive, actionable structural critique.
It is a critique, yes, but the mechanism for change is still rooted in this contemplative movement of naming the harm and expecting the system to yield. Let's look at AI as an oracle, another of Sahali's categories. The text warns that AI becomes an oracle when our consultation of the machine turns into surrender, when human beings simply outsource their judgment.
Right, which we see constantly.
Exactly. And the proposed safeguard in the text is to preserve human responsibility and plural discernment. But look at the structural reality. The market pushes for frictionless decision-making. If you are a hospital administrator or a corporate hiring manager, it is vastly cheaper, faster, and more profitable to outsource your judgment to the algorithmic oracle.
Yes, in the short term.
Right. And the life coherent framework says, don't do that. It harms life capacity. But the market says, doing that increases our quarterly earnings by 20%. And if we don't do it, our competitors will. When profit is the conserving pattern, using prophetic naming to point out the false order feels like throwing pebbles at a tank.
But that friction is exactly why the distinction between a symbol and a condition is so vital. The market uses the symbol of efficiency or innovation to justify that frictionless decision making. We hear it all the time. This AI hiring tool is more efficient.
Because it is, mathematically.
Mathematically, maybe. But Sahali's framework strips away the cultural harm that allows that justification. Cultural harm, as the text defines it, teaches us to call automation efficiency or to call mass surveillance safety. By systematically naming the missing condition, which in your hiring example is human wisdom, contextual nuance, and moral agency, the framework prevents the market from hiding its damage behind positive, shiny symbols.
But the market will just invent new symbols.
It shifts the entire ground of evaluation. You can no longer justify the AI oracle simply by proving it is technologically advanced or highly profitable. You are forced to prove it enables life capacity.
And that brings me to the ultimate edge case. This is the risk that I believe undermines the entire project. The text spends a lot of time warning us that cultural harm works by capturing language. It gives the historical example of institutions calling the displacement of indigenous people development.
Which is a tragic, true example.
Yes. My deepest concern is that the life coherent framework itself is highly susceptible to this exact kind of symbolic substitution. That's a compelling argument. But have you considered how easily this terminology could be weaponized?
How so? Walk me through how a framework designed to destroy performative care gets captured by it.
Think about how easily massive corporate structures co-opted the language of ESG, environmental, social, and governance, or the language of sustainability. 10 years ago, those were radical concepts. Today, they are marketing departments.
Fair point.
Institutions could incredibly easily adopt the language of life capacity and restoring life relation as a new, highly sophisticated form of performative care. I can easily imagine a captured extractive AI company releasing a glossy white paper saying, "We have engaged in prophetic grief. We have seen the wound of our data extraction, and we are proud to announce we are now a life coherent commons."
Right. An empty press release.
Exactly. They could literally check off all 7 of Sahali's steps procedurally. They could hold corporate attunement workshops. They could publish lists of missing conditions. And they could do all of this without shifting one single iota of actual power from power over life to power for life. Because a framework relies so heavily on qualitative interior terms, it is ripe for corporate capture.
Listen. If you're listening to this and thinking, yeah, this sounds exactly like the HR speak my company uses, I totally understand that skepticism. I thought the exact same thing when I first read the opening chapters. But I'm not convinced by that line of reasoning because The framework actually builds a defense mechanism against that exact co-optation.
And what is that?
He rejects that kind of cynicism by insisting on rigorous material reality in step 7. The text explicitly calls out the exact performative mode you were describing. It gives the example of an institution saying we are sustainable while the actual life ground, the soil, the water, the workers, continues to be degraded. The framework forces the repair question. Is the life ground actually recovering?
But they will just produce metrics saying it is.
They can't, because the framework defines missing conditions concretely. It talks about food, water, shared power, democratic participation. You cannot just run a corporate workshop on attunement and pass the life coherent test.
I don't know. They have very good PR teams.
But that final step, making the repair real, demands objective material change. Is the power actually shared with the community? Is the ecological destruction physically stopped? If the answer is no, then the system is still operating under symbolic substitution, and the framework gives the public the exact language needed to call out that hypocrisy.
But who holds the power to adjudicate that test? This is where the rubber meets the road. If the AI enclosure owns the data, if they own the language models, and if they own the distribution networks, they also control the metrics by which life capacity is going to be measured in the public square.
That's a grim view.
It's the reality. They will generate the dashboards that prove they are restoring conditions. The text argues, where the wound is seen, where the tears are allowed, power can return to service. But power does not return to service voluntarily just because a false order has been accurately named. It requires leverage.
Of course it requires leverage.
The framework beautifully charts the path of how a system should heal, but it assumes the system can be persuaded to heal through a discipline of attention, rather than having to be dismantled by strict regulatory architecture or organized labor.
That makes sense intuitively, but the text isn't anti-regulation. Far from it. When Sahali discusses AI as a commons, the paper explicitly outlines the need for public interest design, democratic oversight, and the legal ability to contest machine-mediated decisions. Those are hard structural realities.
Yes, they are.
What the framework argues is that regulation alone, without this contemplative prophetic movement, simply creates new false orders. If you regulate a financial institution without changing its inner algorithm of control, it will just find a new, perfectly legal symbol to hide behind. The framework demands that we unblock the feedback from the harmed. That is where your leverage comes from. The harmed must be able to speak, and the system must be forced to feel the pain of that harm. That is not passive. It is an active, ongoing discipline of organizing power.
I will agree with you on this. Regulation without a change in the underlying logic just shifts the pathology. If we strictly regulate the AI safety without addressing the massive extract of financial incentives behind it, we don't get safety, we just get safe extraction.
Exactly.
But I have to return to this idea of feedback because it is so central to your argument. You say the system must be forced to listen. The text states, harm persists when systems do not have to listen to the life they damage. That is undeniably true. But the entire architecture of modern institutional life, especially in the realm of AI, is being designed to simulate listening while ignoring the actual feedback.
What do you mean by simulating listening?
AI can simulate empathy perfectly. If you complain to an automated corporate system, it can generate a highly personalized, deeply empathetic-sounding response that makes you, the user, feel completely heard and validated.
Right. The chatbot therapist?
Exactly. But simultaneously, it is extracting your data and externalizing the ecological cost of the server farms required to generate that response. When the symbol of listening is perfected by artificial intelligence, how do human beings even recognize the missing condition of true relationship? We will feel heard while we are being consumed.
By returning to the core triad, continue, recover, flourish. You don't evaluate the system based on the interface. You evaluate it based on the effects on the whole system.
Even if the interface is perfect.
Especially then, does that perfectly empathetic AI interaction actually enable the human being to develop their own capacities for understanding, care, and moral agency? Or does it secretly de-skill them? Does it create a hidden dependency? The life test is systemic. As the paper points out, a system might enhance the capacity of one group while disabling another, or enrich the present by degrading the future.
Displacing the harm.
That is a displacement of harm, not life coherence. We will recognize the missing condition because the life ground itself, our physical bodies, our local communities, our physical ecosystems will register the damage.
And there we are, back to the nervous system. Waiting for the physical body to register the damage from a planetary-scale technological enclosure might mean waiting until the damage is entirely irreversible. Outrage notices the violation. Tears restore the attunement. I just fear that by the time these massive institutions finally allow the tears, the life capacity they were meant to protect will have been entirely enclosed and commodified.
Which is exactly why the prophetic naming that Sile calls for must happen right now, before the enclosure becomes absolute. Dr. Sile's framework provides a crucial missing grammar for modern society. By teaching us to distinguish between symbols and conditions, it cuts through the illusions of performative care.
It certainly aims to.
Whether we are looking at the hospital system, global economics, or artificial intelligence, insisting that systems remain corrigible by wounded life offers a highly practical path forward. It is a roadmap to unblock those severed feedback loops and convert our institutions back to serving the capacities proper to life.
And while I maintain my deep reservations about these structural forces of attunement against profit motives, I cannot deny that the text offers an unmatched diagnostic lens, identifying exactly how structural and cultural harm hides behind symbolic substitution, especially regarding AI as an oracle or an enclosure, is profoundly necessary work.
It is.
The warning that machine intelligence could become structurally coupled to our most immature human desires and life-blind metrics is a reality we're already facing every time we open our phones.
It seems we converge on the immense value of that core analytical tool, the distinction between a symbol and a condition. As human systems and artificial intelligence become more adept at simulating our deepest needs, looking at our institutions strictly through the lens of what life actually requires is essential.
Absolutely. We have to stop staring at the dashboard, rip off the black tape, and actually look at the engine.
Exactly. If you've been listening today, applying Sahali's 7 steps to the systems you interact with every day offers a profound avenue for exploration. The next time you interact with an institution, think about the symbols you are being asked to trust and ask yourself what material conditions are actually being enabled underneath. Are we just putting black tape over the check engine light, or are we doing the hard work of making the repair real? Thank you for joining us on the debate.